Hello, and welcome to Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you can find out more about what's happening at Fundrise and where you'll hear some in-depth conversations about the big trends affecting the U.S. and global economies. Today's episode is being recorded on Friday, December 9th, 2022, and this is our last episode of the year. So a big thanks to all of you who have rated and reviewed the show in the podcast apps. Please continue doing so. We love hearing from you. Also, our evergreen reminder that this podcast is not investment advice. It is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only. So caveats out of the way, let's do some introductions. I'm Cardiff Garcia of Bizarre Audio, and I'm joined, as always, by co-host Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. Ben, hey man, you got the eggnog at the ready?
Yeah, happy new year, Cardiff. It's been a big year.
It has been, and we're looking ahead to another big year. In this episode, we are going to do some predictions, that sort of perennial, you know, hobby of people like you and me who follow the economy, love following the markets, and who use these predictions in some sense as part of our work. So what's a good place to start, Ben, when it comes to 2023 predictions? Do you want to actually make the case that this is a useful exercise?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I feel like I get grief occasionally. People say to me, I never make predictions, or only fools make predictions about the economy. And so I want to sort of address that head on because we're about to do that.
Yeah, predictions are hard, especially about the future, the old Yogi Berra line, right?
Yeah, exactly. So what I think what they mean by that is that, like, you know, somebody says something that will happen. And we're not saying it's going to happen, right? We're doing our scenario planning that we often talk about, right? Eisenhower says plans are worthless, but planning is everything. So I argue, right, every investment we make, every person we hire, every new business initiative is based on assumptions about the future. And everyone has these base assumptions embedded in their decision-making. So our job is to make those assumptions explicit.
Yeah. So you mentioned scenario planning. This is something that we should explain again for new listeners. We've covered on previous episodes, but this is the idea that you should have various potential future scenarios in mind when making plans so that you're ready no matter which outcome ends up being the one that plays out. And I think there's something to be said, and I think you just hinted at it, for why it is that we do this, why it is that we predict the future. It's not necessarily to get everything about the future, but it helps us better understand the present. Is that more or less what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. So if you're making a forecast without rigor, that's not the same thing as what we're talking about. But if you go through a rigorous analytical process that's really a planning exercise, then that's a useful forecast. And so one of the things I've learned is that if you make a decision ahead of time, where the impact is like huge if you get there early, right? A stitch in time saves nine, then that was well worth it. And so at the company, we have an idea called an operating principle. We have these principles that we share, we write down to help people make better decisions. One of them goes something like, think through the game many moves into the future. So there's a quote by Jan Thiemer, who's like a great Dutch chess master. Half the variations which are calculated in a tournament game turn out to be completely superfluous. Unfortunately, no one knows in advance which half.
Yeah.
But you still calculate all of it. You don't not calculate, right? So a lot of planning is like chess. Your job is to think through the game, play it out many steps into the future, hold the many contingent paths or possibilities simultaneously, and make decisions based on those contingencies.
Yeah, and you can also make forecasts with humility, right? I think one of the things that skeptics of exercises like this tend to point out is that people make these bold forecasts and then they're never held accountable. But I think what you're saying is that somewhat misses the point that, again, it's not to get everything precisely right about the future. It's just an attempt to understand where things are headed, because you need at least some base understanding to make decisions right now in the present. You need some understanding of where trends are headed. And so it's useful to point out that, for example, in late 2019, if we had been making forecasts then, we could never have anticipated how radically our lives would change because of COVID. Similarly, at the end of last year, I think a lot of people were skeptical that there would be a war between Ukraine and Russia and that would change the world the way it has. But we can just say, as part of this exercise, hey, those things, those totally unexpected things could well happen And we account for that, we allow for that, even as we move ahead and we try to make the forecasts that are meaningful to us anyways. So should we plow ahead and just do some specific predictions? And then afterwards, we'll try to see if we can identify some major themes, if we can find some kind of dominant philosophy that comes out of it. And I want to just relate to our listeners, by the way, that you and I have not discussed our specific forecast before. Like, you're going to share your predictions, I'll respond, but as usual, we try to surprise each other to some extent in these interviews. And so I don't know what you're about to say. We could wildly disagree or we could violently agree. Okay, so we'll see. I'm excited, though. What is your first forecast for 2023?
I'm expecting us to actually have a lot of similar views about what the topics are that matter. So you could go first or I could go first, but we're going to do some forecasts. And then afterwards, I want to see if we can apply a more refined framework. So taking scenario planning to the next level. So I have four forecasts and one framework. Okay. So the first one, not going to be surprising. I call it the inflation rule of 80-20.
The inflation rule of 80-20. Okay. Explain.
So the rule of 80-20, the Pareto principle, is that 80% of the work takes 20% of the time and 20% of the work takes 80% of the time. So applying that to 2023, basically I say the Fed tames 80% of excess inflation easily and rapidly, and the last 20% is stubbornly resistant.
Okay. So by that you mean that inflation will remain, say, above the Fed's 2% target of year-over-year inflation, but it will come down from where it is now, and it won't have the sort of worrisome aspects that it has had for roughly the last year and change. Is that about right?
Yeah, I'll put the math to it. So peak inflation was 9.1% in June. So that's 7% excess inflation. So if you take the 80-20 of that, that's 5.5% that they can get rid of easily. Mm-hmm. And you get stuck with inflation around 3.5% to 4%.
That is almost exactly what I've got here. So to put this in even more specific terms, my prediction is that headline and core inflation going by PCE, the PCE price index, which is the measure that the Fed follows more closely, will moderate into that 2 to 4% range year over year before the end of 2023. Basically, that inflation will remain a little bit higher than the Fed would like, but that nobody's going to really be worried about it anymore the way we have been for the last year. And you can see a lot of reasons why that could happen. The Fed obviously has raised interest rates so aggressively this year, but also there's going to be some base effects, especially around commodities prices. The oil price has continued to fall, and if that continues, then you're going to see some big declines in commodities inflation, of course. But there's also things happening, and I'm sure we'll discuss more about this in the housing market, that should contribute to some of the disinflation. And so you put all of these different forces together, and I think it's sensible to expect, barring another incident like the war between Ukraine and Russia, something else like that happening, that inflation is going to keep moderating, and that generally speaking, that'll be good news for the economy. What do you think?
Right. So interestingly, like, that's what the financial markets are forecasting. But on the other hand, world governments are forecasting inflation returns 2%. So here's a quote. The IMF, the OECD, the European Commission, and the U.S. government all forecast that U.S. inflation, as measured by CPI, falls to between 2.8 and 3.5% by the end of 2023. And all those agencies expect CPI to return to the Fed's target of 2% in 2024.
Yeah. All right.
That's what the governments say. On the other hand, financial markets are forecasting a different outcome.
Which is?
So if you look at the forward curve, which is the market's pricing of future interest rates, the forward curve is projecting rates to fall to 3% by 2025. Mid-2025 is when they're forecasting inflation to fall to 3%. And then it stays at 3% for the next 10 years.
Yeah, maybe one of the things they're pricing in is a possibility that the Fed could raise its target. There's been a lot of calls for that, by the way, over the last year or so, that actually raising it to 3% or even possibly a little bit higher than that would be okay. And it also provides the room then to lower interest rates, because if inflation remains high, then rates will also be a little bit higher. So that it provides the room to lower interest rates when a recession or a potential downturn does arrive. So maybe that's part of the calculus there. I don't know. But it's interesting that markets are somewhat more pessimistic about inflation coming down as quickly as economy watchers are predicting. That's fascinating. Yeah.
Either you believe the Fed can eliminate inflation without crushing the economy, or you believe that the Fed can't and so won't and will flinch and keep inflation higher for longer, right? 3%, 4%. And the market's basically saying, we think it's going to flinch. And the governments are saying, oh, we believe them. And I think that's the one of the biggest contingencies to look at through next year is, will the Fed decide to go all the way and essentially bring inflation down to 2% and take the negative ramifications to the economy? Or will the Fed move the goalpost to 3% or higher? And I think the key indicator to watch is unemployment. Unemployment is the key indicator because, as you said, most indicators or most contributors to inflation are actually in disinflation and decline. Goods, commodities, housing, those are all actually not contributing to inflation. They're falling.
Right.
But labor and services and wages are actually continuing to have inflation. And last month, you saw that wages went up for job changers more than any time in the last decade or two. So they're still rising.
Yeah, there's a lot of fascinating stuff happening around wage inflation in particular. And a lot of this is statistically kind of tricky. Like the idea that, for example, work hours disappointed last month, but that actually contributes to higher wage growth, right? Because its wages are measured, you know, per hour. And so it's interesting to try to figure out what the effects of higher than expected wage growth has been more resilient than others have expected, how that's going to contribute to inflation. I'm still somewhat optimistic that inflation will keep coming down anyways, just because so many of the things that had gotten tangled up in the economy continue working themselves out, like the supply chain issues, commodities prices. Frankly, there's a big contribution coming from a weaker Chinese economy, actually, which tends to prop up commodities prices in times of strength. And I think that's probably also going to continue. So I still think that closer to where the sort of forecasters are than to what the markets are saying. But of course, that is a dangerous place to be. And the forecasters have been awfully wrong about inflation for like the last year and a half. So we do have to allow for some humility there as well. But I'm fairly confident in this one. 2-4% by the end of next year seems like a reasonable thing to me. But my prediction on unemployment is that I don't think the unemployment rate is going to go above 5%, and it may not even go above 4.5% or 4.7%. I think there's a chance that it will rise, especially if the economy slows, but I don't think it's going to go up as much as people have said is necessary to bring down inflation. I think the fact that inflation already seems likely to fall with the unemployment rate staying at 3.7% suggests that we don't need the unemployment rate to rise that much more. And I think, as you said, the Fed is likely to look at that and say, well, if inflation is getting back close to target or at least moving quickly in that direction, and the unemployment rate, yeah, it's moving up, but we don't actually need what some economists had said would be necessary of unemployment between 5-7% or whatever in order to get inflation back down to 2%. That strikes me as too pessimistic. So I would say, to be on the safe side, the unemployment rate will not go above 5% next year. That's my concrete 2023 prediction. But what's your take on the unemployment rate?
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, last decade, there was very healthy growth in asset prices and labor wages. Most people didn't do that well. And this time, I just think we're going to see the opposite for asset prices. And basically, like, Wall Street doesn't do that well this decade, and wages and employment does very well. And I think it puts the Fed in an interesting dilemma of Wall Street will want inflation to come down to 2%, but that's good for asset prices. But it's bad for the economy in terms of people being thrown out of work. To get it down to 2%, I think you're going to have to go a lot higher and a lot further. Which way they go, I'm not going to call, but I think that's really the dilemma to watch and the indicators around that. So I called my next forecast recession in session.
Okay.
Which means a recession in progress. So instead of defining a recession, which I think has gotten a little bit politicized, I thought it'd be interesting for you and I to sort of describe the attributes of a typical recession.
Okay.
So I'll list some and you can add or debate them. So like key characteristics of a recession, right? So one, stock markets and asset prices decline, right? That's like people who are feeling poorer, maybe are poorer, that's one. Two, sentiment becomes pessimistic. Three, liquidity dries up, so businesses have a hard time raising money or borrowing money. 4, companies slow spending. 5, some companies blow up, surprisingly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. 6, Warren Buffett starts spending his cash trove.
He starts spotting some opportunities. Yeah, that's a funny one. And true.
Okay. And then the 2 other attributes that you typically see that we haven't seen. So far, all of those have been checked the box. The 2 we haven't seen are people have a hard time finding a job and there's a lot of unemployment.
Yeah.
And the political incumbents, you get thrown out of office. That's
right.
Carter. That's Bush 1. That's Obama's election. Those 2 things we really haven't seen like you normally would see. So I say like 6 of the boxes are checked and 2 key boxes are not checked. So I think it's underway, but it's not. Once all those boxes are checked, it's a recession.
Yeah. Let me first say that you should send that title to Lin-Manuel Miranda and see if he can come up with a song called Recession in Session. But I would make 2 points in response. First, there is one way in which the labor market can remain strong and inflation continue to come down, and that's if productivity growth rebounds, which is one of my predictions, which is that it will rebound. I am fairly optimistic about that. So if that happens, the labor market being strong, then you can get an economic slowdown without necessarily tipping over into a recession. And increasingly, that is my base case, which is that output growth, economic output growth, employment growth, and wage growth all slow down meaningfully, but they either don't tip into a recession, or if there is a recession by the official standard from the NBER, the National Bureau of Economic Research, then I think it will be so mild as to be sort of functionally indistinguishable from just a slowdown versus a recession. That is sort of my base case. There will be a slowdown. It won't be pretty. You know, some people will lose their jobs and there'll be continued disruption, but that it will be fairly mild, increasingly because we've seen such hopeful signs on disinflation. I think the Fed actually might be able to pull this off. So that's where I come down on those 8 points. But I'm worried enough by those 6 where the boxes are checked that I'm nervous. You know what I mean? Like, I'm very nervous going into 2023 is what I think. So anyways, let me throw it back to you though. What do you think about all that?
Yes. The essence is a recession is inevitable, but the magnitude is in question. And that's the difference between the Fed says soft landing, hard landing. I don't know if that's how I think about it, but the severity is the big open question. And what we need to be watching for throughout the year is indicators of severity. And so the whole point of the exercise is by preparing, you're more aware, you're observing, you know what to look for. And then as a result, you should be faster off the mark when you see something that indicates is breaking one way or the other. Because as an investor, if you can get to the market before everyone else and buy or sell, it's huge consequences.
Yeah, I noticed, by the way, one of the boxes you didn't mention there, and I think it may have been deliberate because it's not something that's present in every recession, but it's present in some, is financial market dysfunction, right? Which is different from just asset prices collapsing. And it's the topic of an earlier episode of the show. And I'm kind of curious to know like what your sort of base thinking is on that and whether or not maybe that has even changed given some of the trends we've seen just in the last couple of months since we recorded those earlier episodes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm expecting financial market dysfunction. To me, that's just such a given. We did an entire podcast on this one.
Yeah. Enough to worry me, by the way. That was a really great chat and people should go back and check it out. And it was enough to make me wonder if there are some things that folks aren't seeing. Because you were having a lot of conversations with people who I guess we could in some sense describe as insiders, right? Not like there's this shadowy thing happening or anything like that, but like people who are actually in the markets and are maybe sharing things with you in private conversations that they're not putting out there in public in their analyst reports or in their research reports. And so I was really intrigued by that chat. And it is one variable that I sort of consider to be a question mark, right? Because if that starts happening, and if it's bad enough that the Fed sees it and has to react a certain way or fails to react a certain way, then that could add another element that leads to a recession. And I'm worried enough about that that I'm watching it. But at least the rest of the macro variables, the macroeconomic statistics, pointing in a more hopeful direction than I think they were even just a couple of months ago. So like to some extent, my base case has changed. And yeah, and I was curious to know to what extent maybe yours had also.
Yeah. So the last episode together, it was called The Great Deleveraging. And that's basically inevitable. It's working its way through the markets. And it's just a given, absolutely given. The leverage has to come down from, say, 70s to 50s at the current interest rates. And it's only a question of, is it going to be a slow motion collapse or one that happens fast? So far, it's been slow. And generally, when things are slow motion crisis, you can manage it. But there's still a lot of pain. And that's definitely going to happen. I mean, there's no question in my mind that's happening in 2023. So I guess I should have put that as one of my calls. The great deleveraging 2023 will be the big story of 2023.
Yeah. And you'd said in that earlier show that the pain would especially be concentrated in the office and retail sectors of the economy. One of my predictions, at least for the next couple of years, actually not just 2023, is that New York and downtowns generally, so parts of New York, Midtown Manhattan, and downtowns throughout the country generally, are in for some more pain and change. And not all the change is going to be bad. It's going to lead to a more hopeful future, I think. But in terms of like the stickiness of remote work, I think that's there to stay. And in terms of people just finding and experimenting with other ways of working, that leads to some rough times ahead for some parts of commercial real estate and certainly for the office sector. I think that's going to continue, and it's going to be tough for some of these cities that rely especially on the tax revenue driven by their downtowns or by dense areas where a lot of people used to come into the office. And I do think that is going to continue. And I don't think it's going to be enough to collapse the whole economy. But I think if I were somebody who was interested in investing in those sectors, I would look really carefully at the trend right now. What do you think?
Yeah. So I would go even further and say the part of the financial economy that gets impacted most by the great deleveraging are the non-bank financial institutions. So that's what I said before, and I stand by that. There's no question. It's already happening. I could give you a list, but that's not for today's episode.
Okay.
The point is, yeah, the great deleveraging is like, it's not a, in my mind, it's like hardly a forecast, because it's like, I'm like, isn't it already happening? Isn't this like, people just don't yet see it as visibly yet. That people need, generally, what you see is that there needs to be enough data points before the general society pays attention. Like what you saw with the pandemic in February is that it was clearly in happening, but general population and the markets really didn't pay attention to it until there was enough sort of a preponderance of data points mm-hmm. that were publicly known. And so I think that's the same thing with the great deleveraging. So, but anyways, let's segue to another forecast, which is somewhat related to this, but not actually directly. So I call this one, the stock market pegs down.
The stock market pegs down. So even beyond the earlier decline in the stock market, and of course, it's rallied over the course of roughly the last month or so quite a bit, you'd think it's going to head down again.
Yeah. Okay. So here, it's a little punny, so I'll get there.
All right.
Okay. So here's some numbers just to try to frame this. Okay. So the S&P 500, the PE ratio is currently 20.5. So the price to earning is 20.5. Historically, the median is about 13 to 15. NASDAQ is closer to 30 PE, and the average is about 15 historically. And then another one, which is the Shiller PE ratio, which basically is like a more of a time-adjusted price-to-earning ratio, is also at close to 30 on the S&P 500. So that's 46% above the average, or one standard deviation. So basically, all those metrics are saying the market's overvalued. But not a lot. One standard deviation is not a bubble. It's just overvalued against historical average. But the flashing red indicator is the PEG ratio. That's why I said the stock market pegs down. Okay, so what is the PEG? PEG is basically price to earnings divided by growth rate. So if you had a 20 PE, 20 price to earnings, and you had 20% growth rate, your PEG would be one.
What the growth rate in what? Specify that for our listeners.
It might be in a company, or might be in an entire index, like what's the growth rate for all of NASDAQ or all of S&P 500, or what's the growth rate forecast for Google next year? So you take their price to earnings ratio, and then you divide it by their growth rate, because in a sense, what you're asking is like, how much am I paying for their growth?
Right.
So if you have a 20 PE and a 10% forecast for growth, right, that's a 2 PEG. Mm-hmm. Right? PEG ratio would be 2. So historically, the average PEG, the average like price to earning growth is about 1. Sometimes a little less than 1, sometimes a little more than 1. So what is the forward 12-month PEG for NASDAQ right now?
I don't know. I'm guessing you're going to say it's too high, though.
5.5.
Okay. And historically, what is it?
1.
Okay. So by that measure, at least, you're looking at an eventual significant correction, unless, of course, earnings, for example, climb fast enough to standardize it without the price itself needing to fall. So if you're somewhat hopeful about the long-term trajectory for earnings, right, you could say, well, yeah, it's overpriced now, but I think these companies are going to grow fast enough to eventually justify it and bring it back into line with the historical average. And of course, that's if you believe in reversion to the mean, to the historical trend. And so I think not believing in reversion has gotten a lot of people in trouble through the decades. I'm just pointing out that, like, that is an inherent assumption you're making here, is that if you think that the stock market's overvalued, it's because it's overvalued relative to what you'd expect given the historical trend, right?
Yeah. So I'm saying that you're paying 5.5 times more than normal for growth is way higher. That's, I think, like 2 or 3 standard deviations higher than normal. That, too, I actually think that growth forecasts are going to get worse next year, and that the layoffs you're seeing from Facebook, Stripe, and all sorts of tech companies, and you're seeing from Pepsi, and you're seeing it widespread, less people at the company, less software licenses, mm-hmm. right? You need less Microsoft Office licenses and less SaaS applications, and corporate spending on IT infrastructure is probably going to go down. And so I actually think that even in a soft landing, general corporate spending and hiring are going to be dampened. And the growth rate is actually probably even worse than what's forecast currently, because most of the forecasts for 2023 haven't come out yet. For most of those forecasts will happen as part of their annual filing at the end of the year for public companies. So you'll see those numbers more in January and February than now. So I actually think it's going to get really worse before it gets better. And it's already 5 times higher than normal.
Yeah. Well, I'm way out of my depth on this one because we're now talking about asset classes. But in the interest of the game, of playing the game, I'll take the other side of this one. I'll be a little bit more hopeful on stocks and bonds, by the way. I think stocks might move sideways for a year or end next year sideways to slightly up. And I base that on a couple of things. One is, if I'm right that economic growth can continue, even after a big slowdown, it can continue and we avoid a recession, and inflation continues coming down, and productivity growth does rebound. The combination of all those things, I think, could lead to forecasts for interest rates from the Fed not being as high as they have been for the past year. And if interest rates fall, then I think that could boost stock prices. And certainly, I think at this point, bonds just look quite attractive to a lot of folks, right? After they've fallen so much this year, especially high yield, but I think both IG and high yield just look kind of good, like good buys. And if, again, interest rates do at some point either start falling, or even if the Fed just follows a shallower path for continued rate hikes than people are expecting, then I think you could see a decent little rally in risky asset classes. But I don't have super strong convictions on that. I just thought it would be useful for listeners to hear another perspective.
Yeah, the counter argument. Yeah. Well, somebody, you're teeing me up for 3 sort of points or
for the smackdown. So. Let's hear it.
So typically in a cycle that goes down cycle, where you want to be while the cycle's falling, like this point of the cycle, is actually in credit. So credit price down.
Yeah.
And I think it is really interesting. And we're working on a bunch of credit strategies. That's really where a ton of our attention's going. So I think that you're right about bonds. I agree with that. Interest rates are a form of a discount rate. So what you value future cash flows at is based on essentially how much you discount them. And the base rate goes up, you discount them less. And we saw that pricing down happen this year with the stock market. So the financial economy essentially priced down this change in interest rates. And that's moderating. I agree with you. But the real economy lags the financial economy. Mm-hmm. And the real economy is going to go into a downturn next year. And the debate is the severity. And that real economy downturn is going to affect the amount of earnings.
Right.
And that, I think those earnings decline. I mean, I think there's sort of like almost no question. And it's just a question of, again, magnitude. So I'm with you, but I just look at that. And I mean, the growth rates people were forecasting often were forecast off of 2021's explosive growth that mm-hmm. was not maintained. And I was thinking about real estate for a minute, just to go back to one small point about residential housing for rent. If wages stays healthy and you sort of have like wage growth despite everything else, then rental housing should actually do pretty well because people can afford to pay their rents, right? They're not unemployed. I hadn't thought about that nuance, but I think that's actually likely, but I don't necessarily want to get into that as a forecast. So I generally believe rental housing is pretty resilient, as you've heard me say many times,
yeah.
But it's in a world where the workers are healthier than Wall Street, like probably more true than even normal. We're still seeing rent growth above historical norms still, probably for us, I think we're seeing 5% or so approximately. Now our rental housing is in the Sun Belt, in better locations, new construction. So if the average nationwide is basically maybe zero now, mm-hmm. Some places are negative, like San Francisco maybe, and some places are positive. We have a regional advantage, and I think a product advantage, but it's moderated. And I think that is likely to continue through next year. I don't have high conviction exactly if it's 5% or if it goes to 2% or if it goes to 7%. I don't think
specifically growth in rents next year, 5%, 2%, sideways, basically.
Yeah, I think that like you're getting to a level of specificity that right. I think is really difficult to forecast.
Yeah. Also, it's worth noting because my prediction for what it's worth on rents next year is like yours that they'll go sideways, but with a ton of regional disparity. And for house prices, I actually think there's a chance that house prices could even fall in nominal terms. And that'll be really interesting to see what the effects could be of that. But I think there is at least some chance that'll happen next year. Again, not high conviction on these things, but that's in the spirit of playing the game. That's what I think.
Yeah. And you tee me up always to say something that I need to make sure I clarify.
Yeah, please.
Housing prices and rental housing are not the same thing.
No, of course.
A lot of our investors reach out and say, well, housing prices are going to fall. What's that mean for my investment? I said, well, yes. We don't own any for sale housing. We only own rental housing.
Yeah, that's important. I should be more clear. Single family homes, I think those could fall nationally in nominal terms. Overall rents, I think, could be sideways. But again, with a ton of disparity between different parts of the country is my best guess.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent.
That's more or less what I think, too. So
excellent.
The for sale housing is going to decline to some extent, but rental housing should be stable with regional disparity. That's really interesting that you're okay. So we had some alignment for once here.
Yeah. And I think we've done a few now. Have we covered three or four? We kind of added a few as we went along. So I don't know how far along we are in these predictions.
I only have one more. So I feel like I should do the framework that I've thought through here and then come back to sort of my last one, which is the scenario three, the unexpected. So I had a lot of fun. Actually, I felt like this part of a new refined framework was more interesting than the actual forecasts themselves.
Okay.
So another one of our operating principles is know what matters most. So I'm saying it's not the predictions that matter most. It's how we actually do the thinking. It's not the what that matters most. It's the how. It's the process by which we think through the decisions. A good, robust, structured process will have consistently good decision-making. And unstructured, unrigorous thinking will usually lead to poor decision-making.
Yeah. And how does that apply to something like this exercise that we're conducting right now for 2023 and the predictions we have for next year?
Yeah. Our original framework was scenario planning. Scenario one, develop a scenario based on an extrapolation of the present into the future. Scenario two, imagine something really bad happens.
Worst case scenario. Yeah.
Worst case scenario. Exactly. Scenario three, imagine something highly unexpected happens.
Yeah.
Black swan, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's the framework we've used in the past. We used that beginning of this year. And so now I want to kind of recast that framework in a different light or refine it and represent it to you. And instead of calling it scenario planning, I'm going to retitle it, How Do Systems Behave?
Okay.
Okay. So the challenge of forecasting is complexity. So how do you attack complexity? Is you break it down and you reduce it into simpler parts. So let me take a shot here. The original framing scenario planning has sort of repeating patterns, right? The patterns are some trends in the present will continue to play out naturally into the future. Some trends will break their natural trajectory and some trends will have something unexpected happen, okay? Mm-hmm. So let's think about this in terms of systems. And there are fundamentally two kinds of systems in the world, inorganic systems and organic systems.
And what are the key differences between those two?
Yeah, exactly. So an inorganic system, which is like in prediction theory, is called a stationary process because it moves like Newtonian physics. It's predictable with enough data and computation.
Right. One train leaves Boston at this time going at this speed, and another leaves DC. Like when do they cross paths? That kind of thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah. But for inorganic systems, like a solar system, right? A solar system, like the planets move around the sun, the trajectories are predictable. In rocket science, NASA can literally slingshot Voyager 2 14.6 billion miles away and predict where it will be within a few inches. That's an inorganic system. But most of our life, most of the things we're forecasting are organic systems. And organic systems have a lot of things that are different, but I would focus on the fact that they're self-learning and adaptive.
Okay.
So like financial investors call that reflexivity, but they learn and adapt from their environment. If you think the input is going to be something, then your output is going to be different. So it's actually anticipatory based on inputs. It's almost self-referential. So like a meteorite doesn't change its trajectory based on it's potentially seeing something's going to hit, right? It can forecast into the future and say, oh, I'm not going to run into that planet. Like obviously organic systems will do that. So talk about some of the problems associated with that and then some of the patterns you can actually then recognize because organic systems do have patterns. So we frequently mistake organic systems for inorganic systems. So like an example of that is that we over-extrapolate existing trends into the future because that's what an inorganic system would do. It would continue on to the future.
Yeah.
And so these sort of are basically cognitive biases.
Yeah. We overweight the present and the visible, and we tend to underweight things that require our imagination or things that right now are just abstractions. But those are the things that actually could end up proving true in the future. We're just bad at sort of accounting for them or anticipating them because we tend, again, to overweight the things that we can see and feel and touch in front of us right now.
Right. That's how our brains are wired.
Yes.
Okay. So although organic systems defy prediction, they do have patterns that repeat. And so this is where I get to recast our scenario planning framework from like a business planning framework to a biological framework.
Okay.
Okay. So biological systems have like three general ways they behave. And once I start doing this, you're going to see where I'm going, right? So one, scenario one. So biological systems either grow according to an S curve or a J curve.
Okay.
Okay. So for those of you who don't remember
that. Break those two down because now everybody's trying to figure out like where does the S go and how does the J move? Yeah. Spell out that sort of graphical image.
Right. So a J curve describes a system that that grows continuously, either geometrically or exponential. Looks like a J, goes straight up. And then at some point, the environment can no longer support the population and the population collapses. So it goes up and collapse.
Okay.
That's a J curve. An S curve is the population grows until it reaches a plateau and then it stabilizes. So like I'll contend that most economic systems are J curves, not S curves. Like in business, people say companies must grow or die. Right? There's no stable present in business.
You're saying they grow and then die inevitably?
They grow or die. If you don't keep growing, you're going to die. Okay. That's a J curve. If you stay as you are in the present, competition and environment will change and you will die. So it's grow or die in business.
Okay.
So a lot of things in business, I think, are J curves. But either way, when you and I are debating things about scenario one, we're really debating, is it a J curve or is it an S curve?
Okay. Spell that out a little bit. Like when you say that we're debating like scenario one things, like take inflation, for example, like are we debating, is that a debate over the S curve?
I think inflation is a good one. When inflation was going like just shot up to 9% and people were debating essentially how it would come down. It would have come down gradually in a stable way and plateau somewhere or would it collapse? So like, I think mostly people think it's an S curve, right? It comes down gradually and stabilizes. And I think that's like the soft landing version. And a J curve would be that actually, it actually behaves a little bit like how it started. It came out of nowhere, right? It was literally, there was no inflation for a decade. And then it came out of nowhere, it shot up quickly. And so an alternative would, it actually collapses quickly. Okay. So is inflation a J curve or an S curve? We don't know. But that's actually a really important thing to have an opinion about as you think about planning for the future.
Okay, got it.
Okay, so let me go to scenario two, which is like worst case scenario. So like under a biological framework, they call that the system's carrying capacity.
Systems so, carrying capacity.
A system's carrying capacity, yeah. So if a population grows under a J-curve, then at some point it outgrows the environment's ability to support it and the population collapses.
Okay.
And that's how like lemmings or reindeer are actually mice. They basically will keep eating till there's no more food and then all of them will starve and die. Like it's really common. So that's, you see how you can apply this, right? Because a lot of systems will basically overtax their environment and then collapse. And so I contend that most financial systems tend to be J-curves.
Okay. So in other words, and I guess we could apply that to things like asset bubbles, or we could apply it to things like dysfunctions in financial markets when there is a big deleveraging. You're saying that when the pain starts, it can lead to a very fast, unexpectedly fast collapse.
Yeah, you're seeing that with crypto right now. Mm-hmm. And so actually economics even has their own name for it. They have in biology, they call it carrying capacity, but in economics, they call it the Minsky moment.
Yeah.
When credit cycles grow into excess until they collapse.
Yeah.
So it's the same idea.
And it's a steep collapse. Yeah.
Right. It was also how biology works.
Right.
Because guess what? The financial system is an organic process.
Okay. So that's scenario two. And then scenario three is the unexpected, right?
So maybe you see where I'm going. So a biological or evolutionary term for unexpected is called mutation.
All right.
So something happens that's totally unpredictable, but when it happens, it fundamentally changes the nature of the system. It's a different species. And if that mutation is adaptive, then it spawns a new paradigm.
Okay.
It's a total nonlinear break from the past. So and it's just something totally different. Like the computer is a nonlinear break from the punch card machine, right? There are these nonlinear breaks, and they're fairly consistent, just like evolution is consistent. It happens. You don't know when it's going to happen. And when it does, all of the way that you analyze the way a system behaves has to change.
Okay. So you've just taken us down a path of evolutionary psychology, and you've drawn out this analogy between the economy and a biological entity, basically. And so when we put all that together, this is where I think you're about to lead us to that fourth and final prediction. I can't wait to hear what it is, because I feel like it's going to be
yet.
Out there.
Okay,
not yet?
Yeah.
Oh, we're not?
I'm going there.
Still,
I'm going
there's more
there.
To the framework. All right.
Okay, now we have a framework. We're recognizing that most of our systems we're talking about are organic, not inorganic. It's such an easy fallacy to apply our inorganic system thinking to organic system thinking. But it does simplify some of the questions you're asking, right? Is there some preponderance of evidence suggesting that the environment can no longer support that growth rate into the future? And if it breaks, what's the magnitude of the consequences? That's a really simple set of questions. And one of the key things is just knowing what questions to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now let's apply this framework. I have a table here. I almost want to show you this table. I did a table because a lot of times when you're trying to figure out if a theory works is you back test it.
Okay. But Ben, don't show me the table, because we have to explain this to listeners and they also can't see the table. So we have to describe
right.
it. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe when we release this episode, I'll tweet out the table.
Okay.
So, I did a table. And I basically said across the table, there's 2020, 2021, 2022, and 2023. So there's the last 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and then I looked down and said, okay, were the changes nonlinear to a total paradigm shift? Was it linear? Right? A natural extrapolation of the present into the future? Or was it a break? That's the table. That's the framework.
Right.
And you go back to 2020 and you said nonlinear break, mutation, literally pandemic. I mean, it's literally a mutation.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the things that flowed from the pandemic, the reactions to the pandemic, were actually natural extrapolations of what you do as a result of a pandemic. Like you shut down, you do stimulus, you lower rates, quantitative easing. All of those things were natural consequences. Then you go 2021 and you say, I say the vaccine was way faster than anybody thought, absolutely remarkable.
It shattered the previous record speed for the development of a vaccine in response to something like this. Shattered it by 3 years, I think, or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So you could put that in either it broke the sort of natural forecast you would have, or you could say it was a nonlinear, but it was definitely not a linear progression of how for vaccines ought to work. I think the stimulus was actually a linear progression that continued through 2022, right? Mm-hmm. That the Fed policy and low interest rates, QE, more of the same, which is more stimulus, more money printing. And then the breaks from the previous trend were return to normalcy. Everybody went back to life in May, practically, 2021. It was just incredible, overnight, rush back to travel and restaurants. Okay, so 2021, 2022, war in Ukraine, nonlinear break. I think at the same time, there are continuing linear progressions. Stimulus continues. First half of the year was a linear progression of the previous year. Healthy labor markets basically continue. So I'm laying a lot down here. Inflation, right? Just broke, total break from the previous paradigm. So that, like, you can sort of, you're trying to apply this framework year by year, and then you look at 2023 and you can just sort of look at these patterns, right? 2020 impact, 2021 reaction to that, 2022 reaction to the reaction.
Sure.
Right? The reason we have inflation is because of the reaction to the pandemic.
Yeah, it sort of, it goes back to the idea that every big movement, every big trend, positive and negative, by the way, contains within it the seeds of its own undoing. As something starts happening, underlying pressures of reform immediately start pushing the other way. Again, that applies both in a good and bad direction. Yeah.
That's my scenario through my last forecast.
Mm-hmm.
Newton's third law. For every action, there's an equal but opposite reaction. And so what I think is like a great scenario three forecast or an unexpected forecast is to call out something that people would say seemingly impossible, like really unlikely. Mm-hmm. And so my black swan is at the end of next year, late 2023, like December 2023, you and I are talking about 2024 and the possibility of deflation.
Oh, okay. I love it. So
yeah.
It's a specific prediction about a future prediction. Excellent.
Okay, let me make my case for why deflation in 2024.
Please.
By end of 2023, people are actually like, oh my God, who would have thought? Like, how could this have been the case? We were literally just talking about inflation. Everybody's losing their mind. Inflation. And so, and now all of a sudden, we're talking about deflation.
Please.
Okay, so everyone is focused on interest rates, which have gone, you know, up rapidly. And that's deflationary, so no question. But I think the real action is in the money supply. So by the end of 2022, the Fed will have removed $522 billion from the financial system, from the money supply. And then in 2023, they're going to remove another $1.1 trillion. So that's $1.6 trillion removed from base currency, like through this quantitative tightening where they sell off their assets on their balance sheet and then basically eliminate that money. That's one part. And then bank lending is falling off a cliff, and bank lending equals money. And the great deleveraging is all about how we have to reduce the amount of leverage in the system because interest rates are higher, which means that we'll reduce the amount of money in the system. And happening rapidly, so like that decrease in the money supply and decrease in lending, I've seen forecasts it shrinks M2 money supply by about 18%, which actually reverts the amount of money supply back to the trend. So if you look at trend, say, where would money supply be without the pandemic? It actually would be where the Fed's forecasting it to be at the end of 2023. So there was this bubble of new money created, and they're bringing it back to historic trend. So that, in theory, makes sense. But in practice, you can't unwind the last 3 years without mayhem.
Okay. This is great because it gives us an opportunity to close on a disagreement, which I feel like is appropriate for us on this podcast. I think there have been some instances in the past few years where the Fed has reacted with speed and decisiveness. One was all that wonky stuff happening in Treasury markets in March of 2020, where there was a real chance of a global crisis if that wonkiness in Treasury markets had continued. And the Fed acted with incredible speed and boldness and applying the lessons that it learned in the aftermath of the great financial crisis and headed that off. And then when it comes to inflation in the last couple of years, like, no question, I think it got its forecasts for inflation wrong and it was behind the curve on inflation. But once they realized it, I think a lot of people have actually been caught off guard by how fast and decisive the Fed has moved this year, raising rates as much as it has, as quickly as it has. I don't think many people thought the Fed capable of that, even at the start of 2022. But the main point that I would make is that it's not that I think that there's no connection between the measures of money supply and inflation. I do think it matters. I just don't think it always is the thing that matters most. And if you look at the relationship between the money supply and inflation in the past, that relationship has broken down enough times that even though deflation is certainly a possibility at some point in the next couple of years, I'm open to that. But I don't think it's just because of how the Fed's acting now. I think there could be other pressures taking hold in the real economy that could lead to that. But it could be that we have some deflationary forces setting in by 2024. I don't know. But I wouldn't ascribe as much weight as I think you do to shifts in the money supply itself. So that's where I come down. But last word to you, because this has been super fun. And yeah, and I'd love to hear more about this prediction about future prediction, if you've got any others in your back pocket.
I'm not saying this is like likely. It would just be extremely unexpected. Mm-hmm. And you can watch for signs of if it actually happens. Like you can be ahead of the curve. If you're ahead of the curve on this one, that would be huge for asset prices.
Yeah.
And I hear you, I'm not a monetarist, but like you can't look at the amount of quantitative easing and money printing that happened the last decade and not think it drives up asset prices and stock market. I mean, it's just, to me, it's like without a question. And so they're going to contract the money supply and they raised interest rates. And so I just don't believe that doesn't cause asset prices to go down. And we're going into recession. And typically, if you're in a recession and they're contracting the money supply, I think the impact could be bigger. It may not be bad, actually, to have like that sort of deflationary shock. But I just think that that's not something people are expecting. It's something you can watch out for and then act accordingly if you start seeing that, oh, wait, this is actually happening. Because if you're not expecting it, it's not on your radar, it's going to be really hard to see the early indicators. So anyways, that's the essence of my unexpected call. I like that we'll leave it as like a possibility. The two that I thought were obvious, so they're not black swans, I just want to say, I think there's a decent possibility of an armistice in Ukraine.
Okay.
And I think GPT-3, which you are probably familiar with, but it's a technology revolution that just sort of hit mainstream media and people like us. That's really exciting.
I'm very excited about discussing this, even in brief at the end of this chat, because my own fourth and final prediction for next year is that the era of experimentation will actually continue, right? I think something's happened over the last couple of years where, you know, because of just the enormous change, a lot of policymaking and a lot of the way that people live their lives has led to some fairly dramatic shifts in the things they're willing to try. One of the most obvious, but perhaps even least consequential, I think, is the work from home shift, working remotely, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. There's been a lot of new policies that have been tried in the last couple of years, whether you agree with them or not, things like debt forgiveness, the one-year experiment with the child tax credit, the allowance, not maybe intentional, but the allowance of inflation to go up as much as it has instead of what was tried after the great financial crisis, which was an inadequate policy response that led to a very sluggish recovery. And in terms of technology and science, it's not like I'm any more of an expert in this stuff than you are, Ben, but we can see that things like mRNA technology are astounding and might yield benefits even beyond just pandemic response. And when it comes to AI, this is something I've been researching a lot in the last few weeks, not just because of GPT-3, which is essentially this so-called chatbot, I think, that's being run by this company called OpenAI, where you can go and you can type in questions that you might have that, like, let's say would have been something you would write for a college essay, and this thing will write it, and it will be sometimes imperfect, but to a level that we just never would have imagined years ago could be done with a computer. And the specific thing that people are now wondering about when it comes to the economy and artificial intelligence is, are these different kinds of artificial intelligence now going to essentially automate away the tasks and jobs of highly educated workers and the types of non-routine work that we thought could only be done by the human brain? Because if you look back at the last few decades, the kind of jobs that have been automated have been the middle-income jobs, the routine jobs, the factory jobs in particular. And the societal response, I think, has been kind of passive, a little bit vapid in many ways, because those are not the folks in those jobs who tend to have a lot of economic, societal, or political power. That's unfair. I'm just describing what it is. Whereas if AI really is coming for the jobs of the people who tend to do the non-routine jobs at the lowest end of the workforce, the lowest income part of the workforce, and the highest income part of the workforce, the societal response is going to be different from anything that I think we can anticipate now, because this is very different from previous waves of automation where people said, oh, don't worry about it. People will adjust. There'll be new kinds of jobs that we can't even envision now. There could be something to that. I'm optimistic, generally speaking, about technological progress. But this is very different in kind and not just in degree from the kinds of technological disruptions that we've seen in the past. So is that a 2023 prediction that we're going to start seeing those disruptions already? No, but it's maybe a 2033 prediction. And I think the process of moving in that direction has begun, and GPT-3 is just the tip of the iceberg there. And for once, I'm not the guy saying, calm down, the hysteria is unwarranted. In this case, I think all the excitement about this is merited. And I don't want to be the person who looks back and is like, oh, he was telling everybody to calm down, when actually it was staring us all in the face that big changes are coming. I think they are coming. So I'm curious to know what you think about all that.
Yeah. I mean, the essence of what you're saying is that the pandemic sort of unlocked a new phase of growth for the country, and technology basically is in the process of paradigm shifting, and AI and machine learning is going to start getting applied this decade in a way that we couldn't have conceived. I think that's right. I mean, we at Fundrise are going to see if we can leverage GPT-3 to do some of the work of the team. The initial phase is it's going to make people who do the work like happy, because it's going to take away a lot of the work that's routine and doesn't require deep thinking. Like, for example, for us, a lot of our customer service are questions that basically the AI chatbot could answer for people. And so that will like free up the team to do the higher level work. So I think that it's extremely optimistic in the short run and will cause a big productivity boom as it gets applied. The reason I didn't include it for 2023 is I don't think you're going to see the actual impact in 2023. You're going to see the impact later. And 2023 is, unfortunately, sort of my forecast is that it's 2023 is actually a recession. It's so much fun just doing these planning and forecasting with you, Cardiff.
Yeah, it's been great, man. 12 more enlightening, enthusiastic, super fun, hopefully informative shows for 2023. That's my firm prediction. And lots more comments and great thoughts and questions from our listeners as well. Yeah, Ben, it's been super fun doing this year. And happy holidays, happy new year, and I'll see you in January.
Yeah, onward.
Let's do it. You've been listening to Onward, the Fundrise podcast featuring Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. My name is Cardiff Garcia of Bizarre Audio. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. If you like what you heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Finally, for more information on Fundrise sponsored investment products, including relevant disclaimers, please check out our show notes. This podcast was produced by Seaplane Armada, who also did our music. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next episode in the